Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident that's going into radiology. In today's podcast, I'm going to be, so this is our 88th episode, I'm going to be talking about a step 3 topic and something that's also relevant for like the medicine boards and the medicine in training exam. I think I've gotten some feedback from people, and it sounds like for step 3 and the medicine in training and whatnot, because these are mostly residents taking this, they prefer shorter podcasts. So I'm just going to make many more podcasts for step 3 / the medicine ITE and the medicine boards, but they're going to be like short and sweet podcasts, so they'll focus on like one particular topic, but I'll still make them case presentations. So let's jump right into it. So what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, let's say they're in the military, they were in basic training and had to be pulled and brought to the hospital because over the last like 12 to 24 hours, they've been sort of having like really bad headaches. They've been having like fevers. I mean, their Tmax is like 102.9. And when you see them, their blood pressure is kind of low, right? It's like 90 over 60. And you observe like petechiae on their skin, right? And then on your physical exam, right, let's say their heart sounds fine, their lungs sound fine. I mean, they're kind of tachycardic and a little tachypneic, but their lungs for the most part sound fine. And then when you try to flex their head towards their, basically like bring their chin towards their chest, they can't do it. It's like impossible for them to do it. So hopefully with all these clues I've given you, I really hope you're thinking about a meningitis. And really on exams, if you see a person that has meningitis and they have skin findings, really the only bug you should think about is Neisseria meningitidis, right? So the classic demographic, right, is like military recruits, college students, basically any situation where a lot of people, especially young people, sort of get together in a group, you really want to think about a meningitis under those circumstances, right? And the classic physical exam finding on the these exams is the nuchal rigidity, right? And really, if you're trying to think, okay, what are the bugs that cause meningitis? Again, like I said, if you see skin findings or they mention like a gram-negative diplococcus, think about a Neisseria meningitidis, right? But if you see, if they say, oh, they found gram-positives or whatever, think about strep pneumo, right? So, think of your Shin organisms, right? Like strep pneumo, H-flow, Neisseria, they tend to cause a lot of meningitis. Herpes can also cause meningitis, so it's just one of those weird things you want to keep in mind. And then if a person is like immunocompromised or like, say, has HIV or is like greater than the age of 50, you also sort of kind of want to think about Listeria monocytogenes, right? Remember, that's the one you have to cover with ampicillin. So basically, if you see meningitis, right, like I said, the two most common causes are strep pneumo and Neisseria. So strep pneumo and Neisseria, they cause about 80% of cases of meningitis, right? And again, fever, nuchal rigidity, sudden acute onset, that's your cue to meningitis. And the thing is, how do you work up meningitis, right? So basically, the first question you ask yourself on exams is this person altered, or do they have, are they kind of like confused, or do they have like signs of increased ICP, right? So do they have like papular edema on exam, right? Or do they have like any like neurological deficits? If you see any of those things, then you don't want to jump straight to a lumbar puncture. You want to do a CT of the head just to make sure they don't have like high ICPs, because if you do a lumbar puncture and relieve that pressure, they'll herniate and die, and you don't want that, right? So if you see like if the patient is like confused, they're altered, they have like neuro deficits, or they have like other like direct physical exam signs of increased intracranial pressures, like bulging eyes, like papular edema and all that stuff, you really want to think about getting a CT scan first before you do an LP. But if you don't see any of those signs and you're like, yeah, this looks a lot like meningitis, go ahead and do the lumbar puncture, okay? And remember, the lumbar puncture, when you send that off for results, that will basically help you differentiate between like between a viral, bacterial, and a fungal meningitis. The thing is, for the most part, if you're dealing with like bacterial meningitis, you have a very high opening pressures. I would not necessarily memorize these values, but I would just say that usually they will give you like a key on the exam, so you know that you're dealing with high pressures, right? So in bacterial meningitis, your opening pressures will be super high. You'll see a lot of white blood cells in the CSF,
And it'll be neutrophils that you'll see. It'll be predominantly neutrophils. There'll be low glucose. There'll be high protein because the bacteria consume all the glucose. And with all the inflammation that's happening, right, all those dead and debrided cells, you have a ton of protein. And then you can also obviously send it off for gram stain and culture, right? And usually that will help you identify the organism in like 70% of your cases, right? Versus viral meningitis, things for the most part are normal. It's like, oh, the opening pressure is not too high. The white count is not super high, usually less than 1,000. And instead of seeing neutrophils as the predominant cells, you actually have lymphocytes for the most part, okay? And your glucose will be fairly normal. Your protein will be fairly normal, right? And usually the gram stain and culture will not grow anything, right? Versus fungal infections. Fungal infections, usually the opening pressure is high, the white count will be relatively high, but again, it will also be lymphocytes, not neutrophils, that you'll find up predominantly. So basically, fungal, I will just tell you this so that you don't have to remember a bunch of crap. If you're dealing with bacterial meningitis and fungal meningitis basically has essentially all the same findings as bacterial meningitis, but in fungal meningitis, the cells that are elevated in the CSF are lymphocytes, not neutrophils. Viral meningitis, for the most part, things are normal. If you see like relatively like normal, like everything, normal glucose, normal protein, but you see lymphocytes, that's a viral meningitis. And then if they do the lumbar puncture and you see like a crap ton of red blood cells, like 500, 600, crap like that. I mean, again, there are many causes of this thing, like traumatic tap, whatever. But really on exams, the number one thing you should think about is HSV, usually HSV-1. So you do your lumbar puncture, and you're like, okay, well, how do we treat this person, right? Basically, I'll tell you this. If you're thinking about treatment, you want to think in terms of, is the person like a guiding, in fact, let me put it this way for you. There are three groups of people you want to sort of delineate. Oh, how do I treat their meningitis on these exams? You ask yourself, are they less than 50 and okay for the most part? Basically, they don't have like chronic medical problems, or are they greater than 50 or do they have other problems in play, right? So, for example, are they people that are like have HIV or they have some kind of like weird immunodeficiency disease? And then the third group of people are the people that have been in the hospital or have been around the OR in some way, shape or form, especially for their brains, right? So let's say the person has been in the hospital for a while or the person has had like VP shunt placed, right? Because they had like high ICPs for some other indication, right? If you see any of those things, then your different, your treatment plans change, right? So if, for example, you are less than 50, you're okay. You don't have any like, let's say like the classic, like college students and all that crap. You want to go ahead and give them basically the bugs you want to cover, right? You want to cover MRSA and you want to cover like strep pneumoniceria, right? So, and VENC also sort of helps with strep pneumo in a sense, but that's a very weak association. I wouldn't even bother memorizing that. But basically, you give a third generation cephalosporin, so you can give like so again, less than 50 years old, normal person, you can give ceftriaxone, that's what's called Rocephin. Or you can give a cefotaxime. So you can do either of those. Ceftriaxone, I think of cefotaxime as like baby ceftriaxone, but it works pretty well as well. It works pretty well in adults. Although it's used, cefotaxime is used mostly in the pediatric world, right? So you can use either IV ceftriaxone or cefotaxime, and then you add VENC. That's literally all you need to do. But if the person is more than 50 years old or they have like HIV or whatever, then in addition to giving those drugs you give to the people that are less than 50, you begin to worry about listeria, right? And if you're worried about listeria, you go ahead and give ampicillin. Okay, you go ahead and give ampicillin for those circumstances. However, if the person is in the hospital, right? They've been in the hospital and then they develop meningitis, or someone has been murking around in their brain, you basically want to cover the two nasty, nasty buggers, right? So MRSA and Pseudomonas. So you can give any drug that covers Pseudomonas, like the third generation cephalosporin, ceftazidime, or the fourth generation cephalosporin, cefepime, right? Although remember, cefepime causes a lot of stomach upset. And then you can also give meropenem, right? Meropenem also covers a Pseudomonas. And then to cover MRSA, obviously you'd use VENC, okay? But if they wanted to be particularly evil on these exams and start talking about like, oh, what if the person is allergic to a beta-lactam, right? Like they're allergic to like cephalosporins and all that crap. For the cephalosporin, so like for the ceftriaxone or cefotaxime, you can basically sub that out with the fluoroquinolone and moxifloxacin. It works well for it can basically sub out for the cephalosporin. But ampicillin, right? Ampicillin, like, there are very few occasions where you will not give a person ampicillin. There's not many people that are allergic to ampicillin. But again, if they wanted to be evil on the exam and the person was allergic to ampicillin, you can solve that out with, like, Bactrim, like IV Bactrim, right? So, like, TMPSMX. And I mean, like, if it's like strep pneumo that's causing the problem, you treat for 2 weeks, like basically like 2 weeks. If it's like H flu, Neisseria, you treat for like a week. And then if it's like a MRSA, meningitis, or like Listeria, or like some gram-negative bug like Pseudomonas, you want to cover for like 3 weeks, right? So I just remember like the 1, 2, and 3 rule, right? So for 1 week, you use that for Neisseria and H flu. For strep pneumonia is 2 weeks, and then for like MRSA, any gram-negative bug, Listeria, go ahead and give for 3 weeks. And don't forget, right, if a person has Neisseria meningitis, you want to treat close contacts, right? So you can treat close contacts with like rifampin or Cipro or like ceftriaxone. Just remember that the rifampin is the preferred agent on exams. So if you see all three of those answer choices, pick rifampin. But if the person is pregnant, you obviously don't want to do rifampin or Cipro, right? Under those circumstances, go with ceftriaxone. But rifampin is the preferred agent. Now, one thing you want to think about, right, if you're suspecting herpes, right, don't forget to give acyclovir, IV acyclovir for like 3 weeks. But if it's like a weird virus like West Nile or whatever crap, there's no treatment for West Nile virus, just supportive care, just watch the patient, maybe keep them in the ICU, whatever. And the thing is, you can empirically, if you suspect that this may be herpes, or you get like an MRI and you see like a temporal lobe, like the mesial temporal lobe like enhancing or whatever, you're like, oh crap, this is herpes, right? You can empirically, especially if you have high suspicion, you can empirically add acyclovir to the person's treatment regimen, and then you can always withdraw it later, okay? Because herpes and like herpes meningitis is almost like 100% fatal if it's not treated. And remember, it classically affects the temporal lobe of the brain. And then, sort of as a complication of meningitis, right, you should just maybe try to recognize this triad. Doesn't always present this way in the real world, but on exams, this is how it almost always presents, right? So high temperatures, right? So like fevers, headache, neurodeficits. If you see that, you're thinking about a brain abscess. And really, the way you want to go ahead and do your work that up is go ahead and do an MRI. An MRI is the best test to help you detect a brain abscess. And really, these people need to be on like IV antibiotics for like, these are people you probably send to a SNF or whatever. They need like 1 to 2 months of IV antibiotics. And I mean, if it's a particularly large abscess, if it's like 2.5 centimeters or whatever, you can go ahead and sort of call neurosurgery, and they will drain that abscess. Well, assuming it's in the right spot. Now, here's one thing you absolutely do not want to do for a brain abscess. If a patient has a brain abscess, please never, ever, ever do a lumbar puncture. If you do a lumbar puncture, again, that can relieve pressures and the patient can herniate and die, right? And again, you certainly do not want that. So I think that's all I'll say about about meningitis. I mean, for herpes, again, the thing is, herpes usually doesn't grow very well in CSF. So the thing you can try to do for herpes is just to do the PCR. Doing like the HSV PCR is what you should do as a CSF study if you suspect herpes. And then for like West Nile, you can try to find like the IgM antibodies against the West Nile. You really do not want to start doing like a culture or whatever. It will basically not grow. So don't waste your time. Now, last thing I want to talk about, right? So what if you get a question about a patient, right, that has like, a large ovarian mass, and then they tell you that this patient starts acting confused, sort of acts altered, and it's been going on for like 3-4 days, right? And then let's say they show you like the ovarian mass, and you see like on imaging, let's say it has like teeth, like they say like hyperdense things that are considered like teeth, and then they say, oh, they analyze the pathology, they see like hair, they see like thyroid, they see like neurons and all that crap. But I really hope you're thinking about a teratoma. And in this patient that's kind of acting crazy, you really want to think about something called an anti-NMDA receptor. encephalitis. This is something, sometimes people call it autoimmune encephalitis. But basically, the classic association is that these people have teratomas. And the thing is, teratomas, right, they contain many tissue types, including neurons, right? So those neurons, remember, if a person has like a tumor or whatever, your body tries to fight against it. So the thing is, as your body is fighting against the tumor, you can actually like have like a failure of immune tolerance. And then you basically have those antibodies sort of crossing the blood-brain barrier, especially if you have like blood-brain barrier that has lost its integrity. So let's say you had like an infection or whatever, right? Those antibodies cross into the brain and then they begin to literally like nuke the person's central nervous system. So again, these people will have like weird symptoms. They'll be like depressed. Sometimes they can be psychotic. They can have seizures. Their blood pressures can keep going like up and down, like super labile blood pressures, or they may have like weird like choriform movements of the upper extremities. If you see that again in a patient that has a teratoma, you really want to think about anti-NMD receptor encephalitis. Really, the way you treat this is you get rid of the tumor if it's there. If they have a tumor like a teratoma, get rid of it. And then you want to sort of like suppress the immune system. Usually, you start with like a steroid, or you can start with IVIG. If that's not cutting it, you can jump to rituximab. I mean, there's actually some famous people that have had this that have sort of had this problem in the past. There's this player that was, he's a fairly famous story, like the Dallas Cowboys. They had like this person, he's actually a Nigerian, Mobi Okoye. And this guy, basically, he had to be like intubated for like a super long time. It was like 3-4 months, something crazy. And then he lost a ton of weight during that period. But thankfully, he was actually able to come back. So some people actually do recover from this, but it's usually not a good thing to have, right? So that's just the classic association: teratoma, patient acting crazy. Think about anti-NMD receptor encephalitis. And then, as I always do at the end of my podcasts, I do offer tutoring for step 1, 2CK, 2CS, step 3. And then if you're a resident applying, if you're a med student applying to residency, so like ERAS, or college student applying to med school, that's like AMCAS, I do offer application advising. I mean, I've been on the admissions committee for top 3 med school. Just hit me up, send me an email through the website. I can give you more details on this. So just let me know if you need help with any of those things, or if you need tutoring with your preclinical exams or your third year shelf exams, or weirdly like OCHEM for some reason, just let me know. I do offer tutoring for all these things. So I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful day. I'm trying to keep this short. God bless. See you next time.